We're back to Author's Corner on the Toll Education Network. Again, tolltutor.net for more information. Twitter, Toll Tutor, Neil S. Haley. Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley. Instagram, Toll Tutor. And Pinterest, Neil Haley. And what's really interesting is I call it the Total Celebrity Show as well, because this is an absolute honor to have this man on the program. And you talk about three-time All-Star, two-time World Series champion, 1980 All-Star MVP. Again, his son is Ken Griffey Jr., so I'm so excited to welcome the program, author of Big Red, Baseball, Fatherhood, My Life in the Big Red Machine, Ken Griffey Sr. Ken Griffey, how are you, man?
I'm doing fine, doing real well right now out in Arizona. Just got finished up with a mini camp for the Reds for the draft choices that we had this past June, so I'm enjoying myself.
Well, I'm sure you are, and always, I guess, around the game, you enjoy that for sure, right? Baseball is definitely
right.
Part of your life for sure.
Oh, yes.
Absolutely, Ken. So really wanted to break down, I mean, this book is just amazing. When you think about the history that you're going to be talking about, you talk about first your life with the Big Red Machine, which, again, I guess every Cincinnati Red, that those years were very memorable for them, weren't they? And for yourself.
Oh, yeah. You know, I was very young in terms of young in age. In terms, I was 25, my first full year in the big leagues, and we ended up winning the World Series that year. And then '76 was the same way; we repeated. And I just enjoyed being in Cincinnati those first 11 years of my career. I was drafted by him in '69, and then I was able to play for him, got to the big leagues. Won two world championships with them. You know, it was just enjoyable for me.
And what did you think of playing in Cincinnati? Especially being with the Reds organization now, what a town to play baseball in, isn't it?
It was a baseball town at that time. I mean, that's all you talk about. The Bengals were struggling, and we were winning, so it was a big opportunity for a young guy to come in, break in that lineup, and be able to play every day in Cincinnati. So it was a great time for me.
One thing you did mention in your book is especially Game 6 of the 1975 World Series. Can you share a little bit of that recollection?
Well, the recollection, you know, I had a pretty good day. I think I was 2 for 5. I had two hits. I know that one was a double to tie the game up, or we went ahead in the game. And the biggest onslaught was the fact that you're sitting there watching Marty Carville come up to pitch hit, and he takes one of the weirdest swings you ever want to see a hitter take. And the very next swing, he takes a perfect swing and hits a 3-run homer to tie the game up. And then we go into the 12th inning, and that's that famous Carlton Fisk home run where he's waving the ball fast to stay fair, and it stayed. And they beat us in the 6th game. But, you know, we knew we had the 7th game to go, so we weren't planning on losing that 7th game.
And that's interesting to talk about, for sure, because probably a lot of people that are, you know, not really baseball historians would thought, based on what Carlton Fisk did, that the Reds lost. And they really won. So, you know, that's one of the biggest memories in baseball history. And yet, really, you guys won it. So,
yeah, you know, the strangest thing is that I was looking at an article and one day I was reading that Boston Red Sox 1975 hat was being sold as a memorabilia item for the 75 World Series. And I said, well, you know, the funny part was that Boston didn't win, you know, and they weren't selling the Reds hats for the 75 World Series. They were selling the Boston Red Sox hats for the 75 World Series. Because, you know, that image left, that image of Carlton Fisk, him waving that home run, and they won the game on that pitch. A lot of people thought Boston won the World Series, which, you know, we knew we had to go Game 7, and that's when we beat them in Game 7.
What do you think made your team so special in 75 and 76? What would you say?
Well, what made it so special was that everyone knew exactly what they had to do. We played hard every night. We had a lot of fun. I think that was the most important, is that we played the game as a game. And we had a lot of fun doing it. If somebody made a mistake and it looked funny or something like that, a lot of guys laughed. We had some pranksters. Tony Perez kept everybody in the lineup. I mean, yeah. Tony was the guy that, you know, he was what we called the Reggie Jackson. He was the one that was a straw that stirred the drink. So Doggy was the one that kept everybody up, live, ready to go every night and ready to play, and had a lot of fun doing it.
Absolutely, and it's something that, you know, that's the memories, and that's a team. And I really like this year in sports because I think it's the greatest years of teams in a long time. When you think about two sports, for sure, and I bring up the NBA Finals and seeing a team in the Spurs, and I also look at the team atmosphere of the Seattle Seahawks. And just to say, finally, we're hopefully getting back to team play, and you guys were definitely a team. It wasn't just one superstar that made you guys. For sure.
No. And you know, a lot of credit, you know, people don't give our pitching staff any credit. But I think, you know, those guys kept us always in the game. They gave us an opportunity. We knew we had a damn good offense. We knew that good offense. And the difference was that our pitching staff, Jack Billingham, Don Gullett, Freddie Norman, Gary Nolan, I mean, they kept us always in the game where we had an opportunity to win in the seventh and eighth, ninth inning, which was amazing during that 162-game season. I mean, those guys were outstanding. We had Raleigh Eastwick as our bullpen stopper, and Pat Darcy, Clay Carroll, Will McEnany, Pedro Rivone. I mean, those guys don't get any credit, but they are the ones that really deserve a lot of credit because they kept us in games.
Absolutely, and that team atmosphere is what wins, and that's what wins championships in baseball, and that's why it's such a great sport, because you can't just have one superstar dominate everything. It won't happen,
no.
Especially because of pitching and different things, and that's what makes baseball special, where you can see runs like years of teams that really didn't have the talent compared to the other teams, but yet got on a roll, got the right pitching, and then there you have it, a world championship for sure. Would you say, Ken, again, after 75 and 76, what do you think, how hard was it to kind of, after repeating as champions, to keep getting back and playing hard every year in your career after that? Because you've already tasted the greatest thing in the world, which is winning a world championship.
Well, it wasn't too hard to get back to the thing was, after we left, you know, they started dismantling the team. But first went with Tony Perez. They traded Tony. And like I said, Tony was kind of the guy that kept everything going. I mean, he kept everybody playing out on the field, and he made it enjoyable to be around such thing. When we lost him, he was kind of our attitude and our backbone of our ball club. And we lost him in a trade to Montreal. And then the next year we lost Pete. I mean, you know, it was tough, but you still got to go out there and try to win. I mean, we came back in 79 and won our division, but, you know, we got beat by Pittsburgh to 79. They were a team concept, you know, because they always had that song, "We Are Family."
Exactly.
We Are Family.
Yeah.
You know, and they went the same route that we were earlier in the mid-70s, and they went to 79 and 80. They were that way, and they played as a family. But that's the hardest thing you think about is that, you know, if we would have kept that team together another 3 or 4 years, we'd have probably won 5 or 6 World Series.
Why did the team break up? Is it the time when finally free agency came into being, or what was the reasoning for it breaking up?
Well, that was one of the reasons. And if you think about it, you know, I guess Mr. Hausman and Mr. Wagner were so far ahead of everybody, and they were thinking of how much it would cost to pay that team.
Yes.
To keep that team intact, you know, and we weren't making that much money, to be honest, compared to what it is now. But, you know, I guess they were thinking that way. And, you know, you had Tony Perez, and he was making probably a little more than about $200,000 or $300,000. Joe Morgan, Pete Rose, Johnny Bench, and then the younger guys, which was me, Foster, Concepcion, and Geronimo, were starting to make our names for ourselves. And they knew they would have to end up paying us. So I guess they thought that way, and they started dismantling the club. And like I said, when Pete left, you know, a lot of us knew that if Pete Rose left Cincinnati, a lot of us wouldn't be around very much longer. Because, I mean, Pete Rose was Cincinnati, or is still Cincinnati.
He truly is. You're right. And that's another thing that I would never cover and ask a question on, because, again, it's a controversy thing. But playing with Pete Rose, I mean, I did not like Pete Rose for one reason. I'm a Pittsburgh Pirate fan. So, you know, especially when he was the Phillies, if you ever say you're a fan of Pete Rose for that, especially with the rivalry of the Phillies and the Pirates back in the day, you'd never say with Pete. But he was such a hard worker. For sure.
Well, he was a hard worker. He was very intense. He had a lot of fun with the game now. Don't get me wrong now. Pete enjoyed the game, to play it as a game, but he was very intense, and he wanted to win it. at any cost. Didn't make any difference. And he was our catalyst. He was on base. Once he started a thing, it was contagious. In other words, he got a hit. I got a hit. Morgan got a hit, then Foster, then the rest of us. You know, it just went like that. As soon as, especially late in the game, but Pete started off an inning and we got a hit, we knew we were going to start to get runs at that point. So it was very important that we watched Pete and kind of emulated him in terms of getting base hits and getting on base and doing the right thing to win games.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And another one I was a fan of was Johnny Bench. And because, again, another unbelievable. These are guys that really just hustled in so many ways.
Yeah.
And they really showed the work mentality of Cincinnati playing for them.
Yes, they did. Yes, they did. I mean, JB was a little different. I mean, he had a cannon for an arm, excellent catcher, did everything right. But the biggest thing I enjoyed watching JB is that he could definitely hit. As a right-handed hitter, you know, and it didn't make any difference. And he hit the high fastball better than anybody ever seen hit a high fastball. I mean, you couldn't blow a high fastball by him. I'm talking about J.R. Richards, Tom Seaver,
and those guys.
You know, and J.B. would hit that high fastball, and he'd drive it to right field or left field or center field, I mean, consistently. And just to watch him play, like I said, the intensity of that ball club alone, our ball club, we played it like a business. It was our business. We played it hard every night. We didn't make any mental mistakes. And I think that's what Sparky enjoyed the most about it was that we didn't make any mental mistakes when we went out to play. And we didn't make very many physical mistakes in terms of errors of that nature either. So we just, on the combination of all the things we had, speed, power, hit with average, we're able to do things, move runners, and we can manufacture runs if we have to. So all those things combined made it a heck of a good team.
Definitely, absolutely. And then we go with Joe Morgan, another interesting player. I mean, because every one of them was somebody that I don't forget, and I didn't live in Cincinnati. That's the great thing. They were a national. You can remember Joe Morgan. You can remember Joe when he played till when he was a commentator. Just absolutely just an interesting player as well, for sure.
Well, Joe at that time was pretty much a second manager, you know, behind Spark. He would just do stuff that you wouldn't believe he understood what was going on. I mean, out on the field, he was like three or four innings ahead of everybody, game going on. So he was like a second manager behind Sparky, and it made things a little different. You're looking at a little guy. I mean, Joe was only about 5'7", and he can drive the ball out of the ballpark like he's like 6'4", 6'5". Good fastball hitter. Heck of a glove. Turn of double plays between him and David Concepcion up the middle. I think our biggest bonus was those guys up the bench. Bench, Concepcion, Morgan, and Geronimo up the middle that made it a lot easier for the rest of us to play the game because, you know, the game is played up the middle. And we had guys that can turn the double play. We had Geronimo can run balls down and had one of the better arms in the league at that time. So we had just the best combination of all the things combined to be a good ball club. That we were able to put it all together and do the things we did.
Being on that team, how much do the fans now, the Cincinnati Reds fans now, like when you think about the Pirates and We Are Family, because I again living in Pittsburgh, but how does the Cincinnati Reds community love those 2 years of World Championships? Like the stories you're hearing all the time and all that. Yeah.
Well, they honor us almost every year. That's a strain. You know, you're sitting there in say we go to a banquet or an autograph signing in Cincinnati, and they call out what we call they start naming us the Great Eight.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that's a heck of an honor to be on a team that they just call you the Great Eight, and everybody knows what team it is, the Big Red Machine, the 75 and 76. So. I mean, I get chill bumps when they say that, you know, when they talk about the Great Eight and they talk about me and Morgan and Foster and Geronimo and Bench and Perez and
Concepcion
and Rose, you know. And we last year, 2 years, I think, it was the first time they honored us in Cincinnati. And it was the first time since 1976 that all of us went to our positions out on the field in Great American Ballpark. And we had a standing ovation.
Well, you definitely what an amazing team for sure. And then the surprise, which I am looking at talking points now, I never knew that you played with the Yankees and that you played under Billy Martin, and you have Yogi Berra, and then the great George Steinbrenner as your owner. So you have some stories about that as well in the book, don't you?
Oh, yeah. I have a few of them in there. You know, Billy Martin, I played, my first year, we had Bob Lemon, and he only lasted 2 weeks. And I think we were like 7-7, and the Steinbrenner decided that, we weren't going very well. And he fired Bob Lemon. And I'm not sure. I think it was either Clyde King or Billy Martin came in the next. And that, like I said, I had, in 4.5 years in New York, you just look at it, I had 9 managers.
Oh, my gosh.
you it was a revolving door with managers and players at that time. So nothing was ever stable in New York those 4.5 years I was there.
Definitely nothing stable. And what did you learn by playing in New York? What would you say? What did you learn from playing in New York? Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what. I enjoyed playing in New York because, first of all, when I first got there, the maze I had to go through to get to the clubhouse in Yankee Stadium was terrifying. You're down that little tunnel and you're trying to find your way through to the Yankee clubhouse, and you had to go all weave through this little tunnel. But once you got on the field, it's just amazing. You played on the field with Maris, Mantle, DiMaggio, Yogi Berra, and you get out there and you try to do the best job you can do. And, sometimes you get yourself beat up a little bit. My first couple of years, it took me a while to get used to being in New York because I came from such a conservative place in Cincinnati, and New York was just like crazy with, Steinbrenner, if you made a mistake in the outfield and he would bury you in the newspaper, and, the news commentators and stuff would do the same things. And it's just, if you do something wrong in New York, they had so much ammunition and they used to just try to bury you in New York. But if you were mentally stable or mentally strong about stuff up there in New York, you can handle it. And, I had to earn my respect, which I understand, and I was one of the ones that I beat him in the 70. I was on the team that beat him in the 76 World Series. We swept him 4. And I was kind of hated for a while in New York because I was on that Reds team in 76, which we swept the Yankees 4 in the World Series. And it just took a little bit of time, and I wasn't planning on rushing my time. I knew I had a 6 or 7 year deal. I knew I was trying to try to be there at least that long. I was there 4.5 years, almost 5. And I enjoyed every minute of it because they were just as knowledgeable, and I knew for a fact that, they knew about the game just as much as anybody else, same as Cincinnati. Those fans in Cincinnati and New York knew all about their players and what their players were into and everything else. And that's what they were about. Then they came to cheer you on, and if you made mistakes, they let you know. But if you did well, they let you know that too.
We're talking to Ken Griffey, senior author of Big Red Baseball, Fatherhood, My Life in the Big Red Machine. Really an interesting story, and I didn't know about the Yankees for sure. And I think that helped you a lot to mentor your son in a way because of going through what you went through in New York, especially when Ken Griffey Jr. was just considered just one of the greatest players that always played. There always are critics out there, and I'm sure you offered advice and helped him, mentor him in ways to go deal with the media, especially being considered one of the biggest and superstars of his time when he was playing.
Oh yeah, a lot of things he had. I knew he was going to have to go through, and you got to go through them by yourself. But I kind of clued him on certain things. Always be respectful to the press because they can always make you or break you. And, if you're respectful to the press and you do what you're supposed to do and talk to them, even if you have a bad day and you sit there and you answer questions, they'll respect you more than you can ever imagine. If you sit there and you answer the questions and you don't put anything on anybody else and you take the brunt of it like you're supposed to, as you look at it and you say, hey, I did this, I did that, and, my responsibility. And they'll respect you for that. But don't shy away from them. Don't pretend you don't want to talk to them or anything, because they will, eventually they can get you. And I kind of try to make him understand that a little bit. Sometimes he didn't get that way, but because he was so young, he was so shy, and he just didn't like talking. It wasn't that he didn't want to deal with the press. He just did not like to talk.
Oh, wow.
And later on, he started to come out of it and made it a little different, a little easier for him, but he understood what I was talking about.
Did you always know he was going to be that good when you were when he was a kid? Did you have the feeling?
Well, the biggest thing was, he used to get himself in little trouble at home. Now, he was living in Cincinnati because, I was in New York and I'd get traded there, and he was still playing ball in Cincinnati. He didn't want to make too many trips. He didn't want to go in the summer because he wanted to play ball. So he got himself in trouble a little bit, and his mom sent him up to me, and I was sitting there telling him, I said, you do know right from wrong. We went through that whole synopsis of being right, being wrong, and everything, and being a parent. And I said, do you want to go hit? He said, yeah. So I was taking him down to the cages in Yankee Stadium, and I would teach him a lot about hitting. I'd throw batting practice to him. I'd throw him fastballs and curveballs and changeups, and he told me he wanted to be a major league player. And I said, this is why we're going to work it. And I worked it. So by the time he was 14 years old, I couldn't strike him out. So I knew I had something pretty special at that time.
You definitely did have something special. Ken Griffey Sr. giving us a story of Ken Griffey Jr. And when you saw his career and you look back, did you expect this? Did you think in a lot of ways that once he started playing, he was going to be that good?
When I started playing with him, when I got to Seattle, and I'm playing left field and I'm watching him play center field. That's when it really hit me. I said, wow, I didn't know he was that good, because some of the plays he was making in the outfield and then, at the plate, he can almost predict what he was going to do and how he was going to go about it. And, it was amazing to watch him do all those things. But I really didn't think I had that good of a player until I actually started playing with him in Seattle in 90 and 91.
He was one of my favorite players, especially when the Pirates stopped having a team. That's the kind of a joke in a way, because the Pirates, with the whole small market thing, Ken Griffey Jr. was just my favorite, because he just was amazing player and really he was exciting. And any time you could just say, I'll choose a player because I'm not going to think about Barry Bonds anymore, there was the guy, and that was definitely your son, Ken. So how difficult was it to write the book when you were asked to write this book, especially about the Big Red Machine and all these different things? I'm sure you were excited to do it, but did you ever undertake something as complex as writing about your story and stuff?
Well, yeah. I mean, there was a lot of things that, it took me almost 10 years to really decide what I was going to do. I mean, after I retired and after playing with Junior, it was my, first father and son ever playing in the big league. So I thought about that, and I thought about my time in New York, four and a half years there, and then early in my career when I played with the Big Red Machine. So it took me a while, finally I got with Pepe and sat down with him, and actually a guy named Tom Bast, he was one of the people from Triad Books, sat down with me, and he said, we think you have something to talk about, in a book. And it just took me a long time to really say, how am I going to go about doing it, and how am I going to do it the right way? I'm not out for bashing anybody or anything of that nature, just telling the stories that just happened to me in the book, and what was my life and no one else's. And that's the way we went about doing it.
Well, most definitely, and I'm sure now finally seeing the finished product, you're so excited, especially to get and do book signings. And I understand you did one in Cincinnati, but you're going to do one in New York and then again in Cincinnati. So there are definitely fans of yours, not just in the Cincinnati area, and they remember your time in New York, and again with your son and all this. The interest is definitely more than just Cincinnati for the concept, especially you're going to be going to New York for the book signing as well.
Yeah, we're gonna be doing a couple probably in New York and a couple back in Cincinnati. Hopefully, we'll get to Seattle and do one or two in Seattle before the year's out. So we'll see how all that works out.
And you like talking to the fans about the memories? Is it interesting when they come up and talk to you about, ask you questions and stuff?
Yeah, if they ask me questions that are in the book, yeah, I talk to them all the time about it. They want to know the whole thing of what went on, you know. So yeah, I talked to them when I'm signing the book and all that, and they ask me a certain question. I don't mind answering them. I'll tell them what's going on.
And how's your son? Has your son gotten a chance to read the book and stuff? And what is his thoughts, especially?
No, he hasn't got a chance yet. I mean, I gave him a book. Matter of fact, I gave it to him last month, but he's been running. He was out here now. You know, his daughter's at the University of Arizona. She got a basketball scholarship, so he's been out here, and his son's already out here at the University of Arizona on a football scholarship. So he's been busy trying to get her out here, get her settled in and everything else for the last couple of weeks. So I told him, I said, you get a chance, read it, you know. So, and I think his wife has read some of it, but she hasn't told me anything yet.
Well, I didn't know about that, so that's something else for our fans to know about what Ken Griffey's Jr., how he has his kids continue to be great athletes as well. That's fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, both. One has a basketball scholarship, Terrence. She'll be a freshman this year. And then Trey will be a junior, a sophomore, and he's going to be a wideout. He's starting this year. I mean, he's 6'5". He's a big kid. So, you know, I watched him last year in the African Bowl. He had 2 touchdowns in the African Bowl, and they beat up Boston College pretty good. And that was his opportunity. You know, he did well, and now he's going to probably be starting this winter. Or this fall at the University of Arizona.
Oh, well, fantastic. It looks like Ken Griffey Jr. has learned from you on being a great father, especially yesterday being Father's Day, and is able to get his kids to excel in athletics as well. So, Ken, where can we purchase your book and also learn more about you?
Well, you can get it on Amazon.com, and I think it's Barnes & Noble. They have books in Barnes & Noble. There's a lot of them, and I know there's a few of them at Kroger's that they sell out of Kroger's book department and stuff. So those are the places, and you can get them online. I said at Amazon, you can get it online.
Well, fantastic. I really enjoyed talking with you, Ken. Do you have any? Are you on the social media end? Do you have a Facebook fan page or Twitter or anything?
Not yet. No, not yet. No, I'm working on it, though.
Honestly, I'm going to be honest with you, Ken. Twitter is just absolutely amazing how you can connect with so many people and how quickly you can become relevant again in this field, especially when you have a book to sell and also trying to tell your story. You wouldn't believe
okay.
how powerful Twitter is, but good talking to you, Ken.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate it.
I enjoyed the conversation. Thanks again for calling.
All right.
Take care. You're listening to the Author's Corner on the Toll Education Network, and we'll be back in just a moment.